south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Speaking of mañana time and lag time, when gringos and expats first get down here to Latin America and start talking about that, mañana time, that is, they're hitting a face with it on day one, usually. Most of us think it's kind of enduring, kind of quaint, when you first hear about it, until you actually move down here, that is. And for people like me who lived down here during the transition of technology, I mean reliable internet and cell phones and such, I remember in the late 90s, my engineering buddies up in the States telling me about the internet, how great it was, how you could chat with people, instantly look up things. They were talking about MP3s. My nerd friends were telling me about how you could download and stream music on sites like LimeWire and pirate torrent sites. Now, I only heard about that stuff from my nerd buddies up in the States, because down here it wasn't happening yet. Even cell phone service here in Latin America back in the 90s really sucked. And I'd say the internet didn't really take off in a big way here in Latin America. That is, it wasn't everywhere until about 2005, just about the time the first iPhones came into existence. And still, the poor and middle-class Latin Americans did not have internet in their homes yet, unless they had a kid going to the university and he had a computer at home. I remember seeing huge computer labs at the public universities because so many kids just didn't have computers. Too expensive. And if you didn't have a computer at home, you didn't need internet, right? And even up to around the year 2010, those internet cafes were booming. There was one on every corner. Used to use them a lot myself. Why? Because they're perfectly anonymous. And you still see them occasionally in the small towns and out in the boonies. Come on, when's the last time you used an internet cafe? I used to use them all the time. I used to live in them. Now, you longtime listeners may have heard me speak about this before. The fact that in the year 2000, I got a radio gig here in Latin America. And for the next 8 years, I was constantly the gringo in the morning or the gringo at drive time at night. I was pretty popular, hired and fired by a number of radio stations. In fact, I was working for one big radio station group owned by, get this, Koreans who spoke no English. It was really great for me because my program was in English and I could say some really outrageous things and no one would call me on it. Anyway, back then, from about the year 2000 to 2008, when I was all over the place on the radio, you better believe, even if 80% of the population did not have internet or good internet at home or in their phones, all the studios and the radio stations sure did. Back then, it was the disc jockeys at radio stations that first started downloading songs off the internet, while the general public here in Latin America bought all their music on CDs, mostly pirated CDs, for a buck a disc. You'd see those guys on every street corner selling music and movie CDs. Now, at that time, from about the year 2000 to 2010, I learned a lot of things about the class divide here in Latin America, because all my buddies who played in my rock band, they were Latino rich kids. They all had Blackberries, flat screen TVs, and internet before any of the middle and lower middle classes did. I realized quickly that the upper middle classes and rich kids who just loved everything gringo would adopt those first world habits instantly. Anything they wanted, their parents would buy for them. It was kind of sickening, really. Sound familiar? So it seemed like when I hung with those guys and went over to their houses, it was like I was living up in the first world, back in Chicago again. Those rich kid Latino 20-somethings in my music group had everything you could imagine, and that was before Amazon, because their parents went back and forth to my jammy, shopping. So when I went to their houses, it was almost like being back in Chicago, except for the fact that they had bodyguards and their parents had maids and gardeners and beach houses. Yep, when America was hooked on Blackberries, all my Latin American rich kid buddies had Blackberries too. And when the iPhone hit in 2008, I think it was, they all got iPhones too. And back then, from around, I'd say, 2000 to 2010, when the internet and cell phone service were extremely spotty. That is, for the masses anyway. However, for the upper classes, for the upper middle classes and my rich kid buddies, it was no problem because they had consistently better and more solid service all the time because they lived in wealthy neighborhoods. And if you've ever been to Latin America, you know the infrastructure is always better in wealthy neighborhoods. Now, I don't know when the internet got rock solid for you and yours up in the States. That is, rock solid for the average slug. They tell me it was between around 1995 and 99. That really didn't happen down here in Latin America till about 2015, about 8 years ago. Before that, it was very spotty. Except, again, if you happen to work at a big company. And, of course, in high-end neighborhoods. Hell, until about 8 years ago, 2015, even government buildings had spotty and even terrible internet connection. I can't tell you how many times back then, when I'd be in a government building for whatever, you'd walk up to the window when it was your turn, the person would say, "Sorry, but we can't process or print your whatever you stood in line for today because the internet's down. Come back in a couple hours." Man, I can't tell you how many times I felt like punching a government slug in the face. Well, at least these days, the government rarely has internet problems anymore. Though it still is a repulsive and painfully slow process when you have to visit a government building. That'll never change. But I'll tell you, a strange thing happened to me when I was doing those live radio shows from around 2000 to 2008. As the internet got better and better, little by little, you might laugh at this, or maybe you won't believe it, but it kind of messed up one of my favorite gigs. You see, during those 8 years when I was doing live radio, I'd give out a really good prize or two from my sponsors every single day. I'd do it by having a little on-air quiz. Every day I'd have one. I'd ask a question on the air. It could be about anything. Politics, music, science, history. And I'd take callers, and whoever got the question right would win free restaurant dinners, free booze, free lawn service for a month, house cleaning for a month, free bags and sacks of coffee, even free weekends at resorts and hotels. Really good stuff, too, because my advertisers knew my demographic had money. Gringos working transnational jobs in Latin America and high-end Latinos who knew English rather well. That worked out fine for the first couple of years, was very popular. Then, right around 2005, something strange happened. Some of the same people started winning over and over again. Well, I couldn't have that. So I changed the rules. A winner had to be on the second or third caller. Though, little by little, something strange started happening with the callers and the answers they gave. In the early days, almost no one knew the answer, and they'd call in just to hear their voice on the radio, and they'd shoot the breeze with me for a bit, give me the wrong answer, or give it a good shot. Entertaining for the listeners, but not a win for the caller. It was a lot of fun, pretty good radio. But soon enough, like around 2005, seemed like every caller had the right answer. Turns out all the rich kids were calling in because they had good internet, and they'd just look it up on Google. As you know, if you've got a good solid internet connection, you could Google anything. Even way back when in the early aughts when we didn't even know that Google was evil yet. In fact, back then I can remember the transition to Google. Before that it was Ask Jeeves and Bing. Remember that? So here's what happened and it wasn't fair at all. First of all, my show was in English. So my listeners consisted of odd gringos working here in Latin America, like at embassies and stuff, and transnational companies like Walmart and Costco. But mostly, the listeners were bilingual Latino and Latina adults, that means upscale wealthy ones. Pure 100% gringo wannabes, who'd learned their English at expensive helicopter schools. And they're bilingual high school and college kids who were going to helicopter schools too. Turns out, very few middle class or lower middle class Latinos and Latinas listened to my program because they just didn't have enough English to understand what was going on. And even though some public schools and inexpensive private schools claim to be bilingual and teach the kids English, and though they advertise as such in their promotional materials, to me, it's a failed system. I've had many Latinos who've gone to those schools tell me that too. It just doesn't work out well at all when your English teacher is a Latino and Spanish is his first language. Turns out that the Latino and Latina kids that actually learn good English down here, enough so that they have no problem conversing with you or listening to my radio program, you'll find nearly every one of them had a person in the home who spoke English quite a bit, like maybe a gringo parent, or much more likely, they went to an expensive bilingual helicopter school and were taught English by a real live gringo whose first language is English, who was hired to work at that school for just that purpose. So anyway, by the time around 2005 came around, all the wealthy kids had good solid internet connections and they were winning all the prizes on my show. Which wasn't all that fair because they were spoiled rich kids who could have anything they wanted anyway. Anyway, I just wanted to point out that down here in Latin America, as opposed to up in the States, the class system is alive and well. As you well know, up by you, everyone had the same grade and quality of internet, rich and poor, all at the same time. And years ago, if you were in a parking lot or elevator or going under a bridge and your cell phone cut out, same thing happened to a rich or poor guy standing in the same spot. But that's not how it works down here in Latin America. Down here in the early days of the internet and cell phones, it was all about which neighborhood you lived in. Better neighborhoods had better coverage, more cell towers, etc. And if you don't believe it, just remember, about 80% of all the internet and telephone plans here in Latin America are called recarga plans or pay-as-you-go plans. In other words, plans without a formal contract. Because for one thing, to have a formal contract with an internet or cell phone company, you have to have a bank account, a credit rating, and a formal job. Not a gray market job for cash off the books. That's why a good third of the Latin American adult population does not qualify. Now, for me and lots of expats and gringos, we like to have a low profile. Keep our footprints and paws off the grid as much as possible. That's why we love those pay-as-you-go programs, those recarga programs. Because you can just buy a SIM chip for $5, get a phone number and internet connection without even using your own name. All you need is an email address to get it activated. You know that drill. So many companies ask for an email address so you can click a link and activate it. It's a catch-22 if you want a low profile. You don't want to give them the email address you use for all your personal correspondence and such. That would be stupid. Because as you realize, every time you give away your email address, they're going to use it for marketing. You're going to get spam and crap. To get around that, you give them a disposable email address. You can do that by getting a StartMail account. Then you could create an unlimited amount of email addresses that can disappear anytime you want them to. Like, for example, when I signed up for Spotify to get Joe Rogan's show, they asked for an email address to activate it. So I went to my StartMail account and I created an email address, something like Spotify1234*. That way I know that any kind of crap or spam that comes through with that email address on it, Spotify1234*, I know that Spotify bundled me up and sold me to someone. Then in StartMail, I just click a box and make that email disappear forever. After all, you don't need it anymore. You just needed it once to click that link to activate that Spotify account. Man, I'll tell you that StartMail alias email feature is one of the greatest inventions in the tech world. But I digress as usual. By the way, I don't make a dime for saying that. StartMail doesn't even know I'm mentioning it. And I don't care either. I'm just here to tell you about the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great. Though, of course, if you want that service, you have to pay for it. StartMail's, I think, $50 a year or something. I know. Everyone wants something for nothing. They want it for free. I want stuff for free, too. But remember, if it's free and it's on the internet, the product they're selling is you and your debts. No matter what their little disclaimer is, they'll never sell, collect, or disperse your data. That's complete bullshit. There's really no way to prove they didn't collect and sell your debts. There's a loophole, you know. Maybe they didn't sell them at all. They just passed them to another entity that collects stats in exchange for yours. You get it? Nothing was sold. It was just an exchange. Assholes. Speaking of poor, or what it means to be poor, man, I'll tell you, the definition's all over the place. I remember in my 20s. In my 20s, I felt rich when I paid my bills with cash at the end of the month. I even felt rich and happy when I looked at the dashboard of my 10-year-old car and saw that I had a half a tank of gas, or maybe even a quarter. I felt rich if I could buy Kleenex and have a couple of spare rolls of toilet paper. In my 20s, I felt rich if I looked in my fridge and there was real meat in there. Cold cuts, hot dogs, and processed meat didn't count. And man, it took me a long time, probably way into my 40s, before I finally got to a point where I could buy what I wanted to eat and not feel guilty about it. That is, when I could buy something at the grocery store and not think about the price. How about you? In fact, I'll never forget the story my dad told me a long, long time ago. He said when he proposed to my mother, he said there would be just one rule in the house. We'll have meat on the table every day. And my mother said, sure, that's the way it was at her house every day. Of course, she came from a big farm and they had way too much of everything. In fact, my dad used to joke. Sometimes I think it wasn't a joke. He said the first time my mother invited him to the family farm for Sunday dinner, and he saw the unlimited amounts of fantastic food, he said, I'm going to marry that woman. So then you might ask, why was my dad so opinionated about food? Well, it turns out his dad, my grandfather, was married 3 times. His first 2 wives died on him. My dad had 8 brothers and sisters, 9 total. Now, the second lady who died, my grandmother, was my dad's ma. She had 3 boys and 1 girl. Then my grandfather remarried, wife number three. And that third wife did not like my dad and the kids that weren't hers. And so my dad says they got served different meals. Her kids got served the good stuff, the meat, the milk, the cream, the butter. And he and his brothers and sisters from the second marriage got mostly bread and cereal and thin and crappy soup, he said. Soup that was often so clear and transparent you could see right through it to the bottom of the bowl. The only time he remembers they had decent meat was on Sunday, when his dad was home for dinner. Turns out his dad, my grandpa, was a tool and die maker who worked two different jobs and was rarely home when the kids were around, except on Sunday. So naturally, when my dad and his brothers and sisters grew up enough to get the hell out of the house, they had a little bit of an obsession for food and things like meat on the table. Man, it's hard to believe it wasn't so long ago. Different world back then, though. I'll bet some of your parents and grandparents have stories like that. But kids today, addicted to their cell phones, they whine and pout about the stupidest things. They don't know the first thing about it being deprived or poor. And the so-called poor people in Europe, the U.S. and Canada these days, I know it's un-PC to say and it's a cancelable offense, but they don't know what poor is either. You know, on my first summer off between high school and my first year of engineering school, I worked a job on the dead dog crew on the Chicago Street Department. You longtime listeners may have heard me tell that story a long time ago. You might wonder, or maybe you haven't, who picks up all those dead dogs, cats, and deer on the road? They just don't disappear by themselves, though they get vaporized by getting hit over and over again. They don't disappear. Well, there's a crew that does that. I was on that crew for a whole summer. I also remember distinctly going to the Chicago housing projects because they're public property too, and we'd get a call about dead dogs there. It would be yours truly that showed up with a shovel and a heavy-duty plastic bag or two. Now, remember, this is back in the 70s, and every floor in those housing projects was owned by a different gang, and you had to pay a toll to a gang member to use the elevator, and those places had something like 30 or 40 floors. Now, inside of those public housing apartments, everyone had AC, hot and cold running water, a shower, a tub, washing machine and dryer, kitchen, fridge, stove, central heat. Tenants had free medical, free food, food stamps and such, free transportation, TV in every room, free schools, albeit terrible schools, paid utilities. But the neighborhood, of course, was deadly. Now, until I came down to Latin America, that's what I thought poverty was like. Those poor people living in those housing projects. Rats, cucarachas, graffiti, and gang members everywhere. By the way, when we'd show up in our street department dump truck to pick up a dead dog, those gang guys minding the elevators were glad to see us. Because, you know, dead dogs get putrid after a couple of days. And we were the antidote. So we never got hassled at all. In fact, the doors were flung wide open for us. Anyway, that to me was the definition of poor until I got to Latin America. That's why when someone up in the States who's never been to the third world tries to tell me about this poor guy or that poor neighborhood, I'd really like to straighten him out, but it's not worth it. I'd be wasting my breath. Because if you want to see poor, you really have to come down here to the third world. Don't tell me about poor unless you've been down here. Take, for example, my longtime maintenance guy, Chippy. He had a steady job with me as my maintenance guy and gardener for years. The guy never missed a day. And I'll never forget, one day he asked me for a Tuesday off. I'll never forget this. That was maybe 8 years ago. I said, sure, be my guest. Take 2 days off. He was rather apologetic about it, too. He said, yeah, for me and my family, it's a big day tomorrow, Tuesday. I have to be there, he said. I said, are you celebrating something? He said, yeah, we'll celebrate. Tomorrow's the day the electric company comes and installs electricity in my house. And man, I just stood there. You could have knocked me over with a pussy willow. All that time he'd been working for me, all those years, and he never had electricity in his house. He never complained or mentioned it either. Of course, that meant he had no light bulbs or TV, a refrigerator or a microwave. Though later he told me he would often borrow electricity from his cousin who lived in the house next door. He'd run an extension cord. But he said that wasn't always the case because he often was not on good terms with his cousin. Now, once, only once, I was at Chepi's house. I was doing a little construction project at the house and I had some cement blocks left over and 2x4 studs. And Chepi asked me if he could buy them and if I could deduct a little bit from his pay every week. And I said, nah, just take them. And I loaded up the station wagon a few times. We took it to his house. It was a little neighborhood about 20 minutes away. All identical cinder block little houses with tin roofs. all of them cooking with wood. No one had hot water, and they had cold water about 8 hours a day. Definitely no AC, no washing machines or dryers. In fact, most of the houses didn't even have glass in the windows. They just had a kind of a thick linen cloth for drapes. Now, this might sound like a cliche, but the people were smiling and happy, unlike those poor people American style living in the Chicago housing projects. I remember those sour and pissed off looks, as if every new day was its own sort of torture. And maybe it was, too. Yep, I believe it was. Moral of that story? Well, let's just say if I had sat Chippy down and told him what it's like to be poor in the U.S., about the AC, the TVs, the refrigerator, the free healthcare, transportation, central heating, on and on, that the poorest of the poor have entitlements and they get them? Well, I guess Chippy would think I was either lying or that God had pulled a pretty mean trick on him. All right, speaking of free or almost free healthcare here in Latin America. You know, I can't help but get irritated every time I see some kind of article, usually in AARP, International Living, or any of the other expat rags and publications, pushing the idea that you could come down to certain Latin American countries like Colombia, Ecuador, and Costa Rica, and others, sign up as a participant in their national healthcare, that is, public healthcare system, and receive first-class quality care. In other words, they're telling you that in certain Latin American countries, again, like Ecuador, Colombia, and Costa Rica, and a few others, you can get on the national healthcare system, the public healthcare system. They're saying then you don't have to shell out for private healthcare insurance. That in itself is a big draw for many expat gringos who are paying huge monthly premiums with gigantic $5,000 and $10,000 deductibles in private insurance plans up in the States. Don't believe it. Don't believe what they're telling you about the public national healthcare systems here in Latin America. Sure, every 4 or 5 years during an election year, the ruling party might pump a ton of money into the national healthcare system and make it solvent again, because they know the sweaty masses who vote have very short memories. But please, don't set your sights on moving to a Latin American country based on their national healthcare system. That's stupid. Yet I still see first world articles touting that kind of thing all the time. You've probably heard those glowing reviews about the national healthcare system in Costa Rica, Colombia, and Ecuador, too. Meanwhile, you've got boots-on-the-ground articles like this one coming out of big Latin American news outlets like El Mercurio. It says, and I'll paraphrase this, the debt for Ecuador's national healthcare system has been increasing since 2009. Currently, it's in debt about $900 million. Since 2021, just 2 years ago, about $800 million of that debt included debts from previous administrations, along with an acute shortage of medicines since 2022, when outside auditors discovered the hospitals were stocked with less than 35% of the needed medicines and less than 5% of needed and required medicines at certain locations. Are you getting this? Less than 5% of the required and needed medicines. However, a recent audit, as of May 2023, reports that certain public hospitals have 78% of the needed and required medicines, and 35% of the required and needed medicines are available in 48 of the national healthcare dispensaries. Meanwhile, it says, medical professionals do not want to work for the national healthcare system. I wonder why. Maybe it's because they have to bring their own medicine. It says they much prefer working in private clinics and hospitals. Because of that, there's a shortage of around 2,000 professionals in the nation's national healthcare facilities. It says on July 1st, 2023, there have been posted over 1,000 job listings in the national healthcare system. So who are you going to believe? American retirement rags like AARP and International Living? Or articles coming out in Spanish language newspapers in said countries? The thing is, though, retired people and seniors in the States are going to read International Living and AARP before they ever pick up a local Spanish language newspaper. That might happen, but probably never. All right, moving on. Remember in the last show I was talking about municipal water supplies and why you have to really be careful if you're moving or buying a place that's hooked up to a municipal or city water supply? I mentioned if you are hooked up to a municipal supply, you're going to need a big-ass cistern because a lot of those municipal supplies are only on 8, 10, or 12 hours a day. The other thing, though, is if you have a house in the city that's hooked up to the municipal water supply, you could still, if you're dissatisfied with your municipal water hookup, call in a well digger and they can put in a private well for your house. Last time I checked, in Central America anyway, Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, El Salvador, that could run you $3,000 to $5,000. But well worth it, pun intended. And if you're wondering about permits for such a thing, because up in the States you could never get away with that. Not in the city limits anyway, unless you lived way out in the boonies, then maybe you could pull it off. But forget about it if you own a house in the city. You're going to be hooked up to municipal supply whether you like it or not. But in Latin America, all you do is call the well company up and they handle everything. Now, about the necessary well digging permits. Somehow they're always connected. They have a sweetheart deal or two going with the city and no one I've ever talked to has had a problem. Of course, we're talking about if you own your own home and have a big yard or garden where they can dig that well. If you own an apartment or a townhouse, forget about it. However, the point is, you should have a plan B when you're on municipal water. For example, in one of my most recent houses, I had the roof redone so that I could reroute all the rainwater to a big cistern. So I had a big supply as a plan B in case of emergency. And in the 2 years I had that thing in place, I never had to use it. But it was there nevertheless, just in case. You never know. Now, just to show you once again how bad municipal water supplies can be, I'm reading from El Mercurio again. Title of the article, and I'll translate and condense this. Failure in Miraflores leaves 47 sectors without water service. It says about 5,000 families have been affected by the lack of or intermittent water service in 47 sectors. The municipal water complaints, which started 7 months ago, have intensified in the last month. Recent inspections have shown the problem is due to at least 6 broken or cracked underground pipes. Now, pay attention to this. It says, Maria Veronica Polo, manager of the ETAP Municipal Water Service, says that from the damage, which dates back 7 years, has worsened. Meanwhile, it says, since November 2022, about 6 months ago, those 47 affected sectors are being served by 3 rotating water tankers circulating in and out of those affected neighborhoods. Well, that's nice, huh? Are you getting this? I repeat, if you're on municipal water, have a plan B. Easy enough if you own the place. Get a big cistern, divert and collect your rainwater, or get a well. And if you're renting, well, make sure your place has a big cistern. If not, your plan B would be thinking about moving to a place that does.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.